coming in, and I welcome you all to this evening's event. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd just like to remind you of next week's talk, where we're moving back to the Middle Ages. Professor Sean Eckhart of the Department of English at UBC, one of the leading Arthurian scholars in North America, will be talking about the once and present king, Arthur, medieval and modern. This evening, however, it's a great pleasure to have with us Mr. Daniel Snowman. Mr. Snowman is a Londoner, educated at Cambridge, with graduate work at Cornell University in the United States. He began a teaching career at the New University of Sussex in Brighton in 1964, but soon was lured away by the British Broadcasting Corporation, for which he served as a senior producer, eventually in charge of all radio features for BBC, especially the cultural aspect of the BBC. He, during that time, published numerous books and continues to publish and to lecture around the world. He's been on the road for nearly 60 days now, and we're his second to last stop, I believe. His works cover a very wide area from the polar regions of the world to Eleanor Roosevelt, to a history of the United States from the 1920s to Vietnam, to a collection of essays from History Today, a magazine with which he's been long associated. He's also written a biography of Placido Domingo and was associate producer for the BBC for a four-part television series on Domingo that was later sold to PBS in North America. Some of you may have had the opportunity to see it. Most recently, however, he has published a major book on Hitler's emigres, the cultural impact on Britain of refugees from Nazism. Mr. Snowman.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the introduction. I'm delighted to be here. And as Hector Williams said, it's particularly good to see you on a night when I know a lot of people are watching television for political results. We have a little scheme that if the result comes through, we might even be able to share it with you later on. I'm very thrilled to be in what has always been one of my favorite cities. I haven't been to Vancouver for about 30 years, but it's a very great thrill to be back. What I want to share with you this evening is the subject matter of the recent book that I've written about the cultural impact of the Hitler emigres. From this rather variegated biography that was just read out, it might sound as though it's only a recent interest of mine. In a sense, the subject of the cultural impact of the refugees from Nazism is really something that I've lived with all my life. I was brought up in northwest London. I remember being taken, my parents were very musical, they took me to the Wigmore Hall in London where I first heard the Beethoven quartets, played by the Amadeus Quartet, for example. Years later, I got to know the members of the Amadeus Quartet, the great quartet of those days, three of whom were refugees from Nazism. And I began to ask myself, and indeed ask them, what was it that they brought with them from Central Europe to Britain? Was there something in the oxygen in Vienna that made people play differently? Well, no, you go to Vienna, one of them said this to me, he said, Daniel, don't be so silly, you go to Vienna, people are as musically illiterate there as anywhere else. You know, what they care about is the football results or the mayoral elections. but, which is true in London too. But then I gradually began to think over the years, everywhere I turned, there seemed to be interesting people, not only in the cultural world, but in business, in the sciences, in industry, but particularly the cultural worlds that interested me, in art history, in the academic world, in music, in film, in architecture, who had German names. and who seemed to have brought to Britain something of the Central European culture they were raised in. So what I want to do this evening, ladies and gentlemen, is try and talk about these two cultures, the two different worlds. The world of pre-Hitlerian Central Europe. The world of expressionist film, of Bauhaus architecture, of Schönbergian music, of modernism with a capital M. Because this was the world that so many of those who were lucky enough to escape from Hitler brought with them in their heads when they transferred from Central Europe to Britain and to North America and to Australia and elsewhere. Those who came to Britain and settled in Britain, they didn't come to a world with no culture. Britain was not a land without culture in the 20s and 30s. It was a land of a considerable culture, but a very different one. This was a world of the Bloomsbury Group, of Lord Reith's BBC, of Vaughan Williams, our leading composer, of Lutyens and architects who were very often being asked to reproduce Georgian style, Elizabethan style. Vaughan Williams writing a pastoral symphony or writing variations on a theme of Thomas Tallis, Tudor composer. I was brought up in a house in Edgware in northwest London that my parents built, and it was a kind of semi-detached pebble dash with a great big Elizabethan beam down it, built in 1938. We liked in Britain in the 20s and 30s to cover ourselves in a certain degree of insularity, a certain pastoralism, a certain reflection on the past. Very different from the Bauhaus, expressionist, modernist, Schönbergian, Middle Europe. So what I want to talk about is the impact of these two cultures upon each other. I'm not going to bore you with a list of famous names. There'll be a lot of famous names in what I have to say. I've already mentioned the Amadeus Quartet. I was lecturing in the course of this trip in New Zealand, and I was talking about the great philosopher Karl Popper, who wrote some of his most important work in New Zealand, where he was a refugee during the war before coming on to Britain. I'm not going to talk much about North America. There's a huge U.S. story, of course, as well. Einstein, Thomas Mann, Brecht, all the Hollywood story. I want to stick to the U.K. and ask in the first part of the lecture, what was the culture of pre-Hitlerian Central Europe that these people, many of them Jewish, many of them not Jewish, many of them who were Jewish, very assimilated Jewish, didn't think of themselves as Jewish until Hitler forced them to think of themselves as Jewish. What was that world they grew up in? What was the culture they carried with them to Britain? And then towards the end of the lecture, we will cross the North Sea as they did, and I'll try and suggest what they did with that culture when they carried it to Britain. I should say, just before I put the lights out and start showing the slides, which I'm about to do, my book has this really rather boring title, The Hitler Emigres. It was originally, the publishers very generously, I think there's a representative of them here, very generously said to me, you know, what would you like your book to be called? And I tried very hard to think of a kind of three-word title that said, the artistic, cultural, and intellectual world of Central Europe that many people, some of them Jewish, brought with them to the Britain of... You know. And the only title I could come up with was, the original title was going to be The Culture Carriers. The Culture Carriers. It's a good title until somebody in the marketing department said it sounds as though they brought AIDS or Ebola or, you know, mad cow disease or something. So it's The Hitler Emigres with a nice subtitle about the cultural impact of, I prefer the word emigres to refugees because some of the people I'm talking about were not refugees. Max Perutz, the great biochemist who I know visited here some years ago and died, I think, last year, wasn't a refugee. He came to Britain as a student and stayed and found it was a better place to be than Vienna. So emigres is probably a better title, and what I'm going to talk to you about tonight is the cultural impact of the emigres from Central Europe on British cultural life. Now, I need to take out yet more technology. This is a death ray gun, which I need... Just tell me if I pointed in the wrong direction, will you? I've also been told how to turn the lights out and how to put the slide... Voila, we're in business. If I stand in the way, tell me to get out of the way. I thought we would start, ladies and gentlemen, with a few slides by way of a general introduction, because I know this sounds as though it could be a dangerously long five-hour Wagnerian lecture with a lot of very long Teutonic names. And I want to start by suggesting that you may be more familiar with some of the subject matter than you perhaps think. I was talking to a lady before who told me that she loved ballet and when she was a girl was trained in the dance. And many of you will remember the film, The Red Shoes, lovely English film with pretty Moira Shearer twirling around. It's a film not only about ballet. It's a film about a girl who meets a rather ruthless impresario, a kind of Diaghilev figure, who says to her, "You want to dance? You want to dance in my company? You practice, you know, 19 hours a day, no boyfriends, no fripperies, I will make you the finest ballerina in the world, or else you're out." Now, the person playing that role, wonder if you remember, was Anton Walbrook, born Adolf Walbrück. The person who did the designs of the film, it was a very beautifully designed film, it won the Oscar that year for design, was Hein Heckroth. And interestingly, most interestingly, perhaps the person who wrote the film was Emmerich Pressburger. That film is very much, although people think of it as an archetypal English film, very much a product of Central European filmic sensibility. Remember that in the 1920s, I mean, Hollywood, of course, existed, but Berlin was probably the artistic center of the film world. Many of the great figures who later on went to Hollywood, to the States, Fritz Lang, Billy Wilder, who I think died earlier this year, many of them cut their teeth, learnt their trade in the Berlin of the 1920s. Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock, went to Berlin to learn film in the 1920s. And I'll have quite a lot to say about British film later on, because the history of film in Britain over my lifetime has been very much influenced by the émigrés from Central Europe. I'll be talking about art, I'll be talking about decorative art, I'll be talking about cartoons. I love political cartoons. I'll have quite a lot to say about cartoonists like, I mean, the man who was probably the greatest political cartoonist in Britain since the war was Vicky. Victor Weiss's name was Vicky. It took the temerity, it took the audacity of a foreigner in Britain, somebody untouched by the British class restrictions, to observe our then Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. Some of you will remember old pseudo-Edwardian Harold Macmillan with his droopy moustache, and to see Macmillan as a kind of Superman figure in disguise and call him Super Mac. We'll be talking about Vicky, and in the course of the lecture I want to suggest where I think some of his ideas came from. Some of his drawing style goes back to the Berlin of the 1920s, but I'll also show you where I think his ideas led on to. We'll be talking about publishers, many of our great publishers, Weidenfeld, Deutsch, the art publishers, Feiden and Thames and Hudson, both of them the creation of refugees from Vienna, the great art publishers, Feiden and Thames and Hudson. And we'll be talking about music. Here are my friends, the Amadeus Quartet, three of them happily still alive. When the book of mine was published in the spring, in May, we had an evening on the BBC, which I presented, and I was able to have a lot of interviews and feature material. And one of the features we did was I went back to Vienna with Zygmunt Nissel, still alive, lovely man, he's 80 now. He and I went to Vienna, and he told me this was where I had my first violin lesson. This was where I went to school. What it was like being a young Jewish violinist in immediately pre-Hitlerian Vienna, and then Hitlerian Vienna. And we went one night to the Heurigen, you know, the places just to the north of Vienna where you can have the fresh wine in a rather rural environment. And we drank a bit, and these Schrammel musicians came from table to table with their slightly out-of-tune instruments and sang the old songs of Vienna. And he joined in. He joined in and he said to me, you know, Daniel, these were the songs my father used to teach me, these sentimental old Viennese songs, and the tradition of those kind of minor major modes and the long romantic rests on some of the notes, the rubato, goes back, he said, to the time of Schubert. And maybe something of the rather rich romantic style of the Amadeus Quartet can be traced back to those origins of the popular music in the Heurigen of Vienna. I don't know, but anyway, that again is what I'm interested in, the cultural carrying of something from Central Europe through people like three members of the Amadeus Quartet to British music making. And we'll be talking about architecture. On your right is the central staircase in the pavilion, the De La War Pavilion or De La Ware Pavilion on the south coast of England in Bexhill-on-Sea in Sussex. A modern building, capital M, modern circa mid-1930s, modernism. Every time I use the word modern or modernist or modernism, think of it as having a capital M. What did it mean in architectural terms at that time? Well, to Eric Mendelssohn, for example, it meant modern materials, steel, glass, very geometrical, no unnecessary decor, and very often rather rectilinear in the style of the building as a whole, that particular one, painted white, flat roof, rather the trademark of that kind of building. We'll be talking also, therefore, about architecture in the course of this evening. You know, incidentally, those of you who are familiar with London, I wonder if you know what is probably the first most famous permanent example of modernist building in Britain is something built not for people, but for penguins. And it is the penguin pool at London Zoo, designed by Berthold Lubetkin, another who, by the way, was not a refugee but came to Britain in 1931, was born, I think, in Russia. He was a bringer of the European style, the international style to British architecture. When he was commissioned to build a penguin pool for London Zoo, look what he built. I speak to you with special authority here because, as was mentioned, I've written about the polar regions. I've been several times to Antarctica, and I have seen zillions of penguins waddling around in their natural habitat, and I can assure you they do not waddle around on a double helix DNA-reinforced concrete as they do at London Zoo. But it works. It works very well. Lubetkin and his colleagues in a company called Tecton, it was a kind of social engineering. They would observe scientifically the behavior of penguins. They would observe scientifically the behavior of people watching penguins. And then, with this kind of geometricity and formality and modernity of materials and style, no decor, no naturalism, no serious gesture towards Antarctic structures, they would create the perfect environment. And it works. It works. So we'll be talking about architecture. We'll be talking about music and opera. If I'm a great opera lover. The fact that I've worked with the Placido Domingo was mentioned. So I'm going to show you an opera house. Now, the opera house I'm showing you is one that, again, you might not particularly think of as anything other than very English. It's Glyndebourne. Glyndebourne, the archetypal English country house opera based in the rolling hills of Sussex, the creation of a typical old, rich, eccentric English landowner, John Christie. But what's Glyndebourne famous for? Glyndebourne is famous for the integration of the arts of opera, serious rehearsal time, singers who know what they're singing about and can act and can integrate their performances with what the conductor is doing and what the decor requires. And the founding fathers of Glyndebourne artistically were Carl Ebert, the director, and Fritz Busch, the conductor. Two people, neither of them Jewish, by the way, both of whom couldn't stand a regime, the Nazi regime that burned books and told them whom they could employ in the orchestral pit and whom they couldn't. And these people brought a kind of professional standard of integrated operatic production to Britain for the first time. There was nothing like this on a regular annual basis in Britain until the creation of Glyndebourne. And incidentally, Glyndebourne was run during its early years, right through that period in the 30s and on, by Rudolf Bing, refugee from Vienna, who later on became the creator of the Edinburgh Festival, and later on still came to this side of the pond and became very famous as the director of the New York Metropolitan Opera. Again, I want to emphasize that although there's a great deal of talent and a great deal of seriousness, while working on my book, I was very privileged to be able to meet many of the great survivors of that period, and also, because I was doing some broadcasts, to listen to many, many hours of BBC archives of people like Bush and Abbott and Bing and others long since dead. And what amazed me, I shouldn't have been amazed, but what really especially delighted me perhaps was that in addition to encountering directly and indirectly many very great achievers to whom I think we owe a great deal, I also encountered a great deal of wit and irony. It was as though people had been on the edge of catastrophe and had thought, if I survive this, my God, I'm going to enjoy the rest of my life. And I heard a lot of wit, a lot of humor, a lot of outrageous fun that I couldn't possibly repeat in a large audience of this kind. But I want to give you one example of that wit. Some of you will remember the cartoonist Gerhard Hoffnung, died much too young, little boy from Berlin, used to be taken on holidays, incidentally, with another little boy from Berlin, André Previn, who despite his name was not French, but a Berliner, another émigré from Hitler who went to Hollywood and then elsewhere. Hoffnung was a wonderful cartoonist. He loved music. He put on zany concerts at the Royal Festival Hall in London, you know, a concerto for string orchestra, vacuum cleaner, and hosepipe. And he would go to his long, you know, he'd go to Parsifal or Lohengrin, and he would love it, but then he'd go home and he would draw what he felt he'd seen that day. And it would come out like this. The Hoffnung cartoons. And so this is just a sample of some of the figures that I'll be talking about and the kind of range of what it was that they brought to British cultural life. Now, I want to do what I said I would do, and I want to take you back to the intellectual, artistic, cultural life, particularly the artistic life, perhaps, of pre-Hitlerian Central Europe. Think of the Vienna of Freud and Mahler and Klimt and Adolf Loos and Schnitzler and Jan Kokoschka. Think of the Berlin of the Weimar period, the 1920s, of Brecht, of the Threepenny Opera, Kurt Weill, of satire, of cabaret, that harsh wit. Let's go back to the pre-Hitlerian era, and I want, because time is limited, to break this up into three little subsections, and forgive me, the experts among you, I'm going to be far too brief and far too schematic. I want to say a few words about expressionism. I want to say a few words about, I don't know what to call it, mechanical grandeur, the penguin pool, the sky's the limit. Modernity can achieve anything with modern machinery, if you like, and modern science. And thirdly, lest you think this sounds very inhumane, I want to say a few words about the great social and political conscience of many of the people that I'll be talking about. Let's turn, first of all, to expressionism. What does expressionism mean? It's a kind of riposte in some ways to impressionism. You know, by 1912, certainly by 1914, 15, 16, impressionism to many people was beginning to look and to sound too soft, too old-fashioned, too lavendery, didn't really express the strong and dangerous emotions that people have. A number of artists, particularly in places like Munich, were beginning to try to express the very strong, dangerous, the murderous emotions, the sexual emotions that they felt art hadn't adequately confronted before. We recently had a double bill at Covent Garden in London of Erwartung by Schoenberg and also the Bartok Bluebeard. Two expressionist one-act operas, not beautiful, not pretty sounds, but deeply plumbing the dangerous sexual and murderous emotions that the composers felt it was art's duty to confront. I want to give you one or two visual examples, and I want to go back to film, since I began by mentioning film, and that Berlin was perhaps artistically the great film capital of the time. I want to show you a couple of slides from what was one of the most seminal films in movie history, and that is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Made after the First World War in Berlin, very cheaply. The story needn't delay us. It's about this enigmatic, strange doctor figure who has a fairground act. He has a somnambulist whom he can hypnotize into telling your fortune, and it transpires there are various murders going on, and the somnambulist is obviously being hypnotized to abduct people and kill them. The story needn't concern us. Have a look at the design. Remember I used words before like anti-naturalistic. At no point does Dr. Caligari walk down a real corridor or in a real fairground. This is deliberately artificial, painted flats, very cheap. It's the unreality is not disguised. Very strong lateral lines, very thick geometric lines, quite geometric in various places. Look at those angles. Very angular, perhaps, is a better word. Look at the angularity of the walls. They're tapering in. They're threatening. You know, you go to that film. I saw it again recently in London. And after 80 minutes or 90 minutes, whatever it is, you come out, you just think that the stairs are going to swallow you up. It's that kind of film. When the somnambulist is abducting somebody over the roofs at night, you look at that. Now, of course, those are only actors and shadow effects and painted flats. And yet, involuntarily, you can't help wondering whether they might fall off the roof or whether the chimneys are going to close in on them. And if they don't fall in off the roof, maybe they'll slip down there. You know, the whole thing is designed to create a sense of of emotional dislocation, of danger, of emotional incoherence and uncertainty. Lighting effects. Look at the great sense of light and darkness. Very often, if you look at the designs, theatrical designs from the Weimar period, in early Brecht period, Martin Esslin, who was a great Hitler refugee and also the expert on Brecht and a great man in the BBC, used to say that you would often see this strong horizontal lighting in the maquettes of some of the theatrical designs to suggest exaggerated emotion. You get that in film, you get that in Caligari. That shadow effect is obviously calculated. It's obviously exaggerated, and yet it's nonetheless shocking for that. I'll give you one more film example, and this is by a film by Fritz Lang, one of the great émigré film directors. One of the films he made in Germany still was M, Murder, Murderer, with Peter Lorre. A film about a subject still very sadly with us to this day. Much of what I'm mentioning is not just history, of course it has applications to our own times, as I'll say at the end. M is about a man who chats up little girls and presumably sexually abducts them and kills them. And there's an amazing shot in the film where we see this young adolescent girl, innocent girl. She's looking innocently up at the cameras, and behind her is a wall, and on the wall is a poster. I think it's advertising a reward leading to the arrest of the man who's killing young girls. And on the poster is the shadow of the man she's talking to. It's calculated, it's art, it's expressionism. It is the expression, the calculated expression of these dangerous emotions, the sexual and perhaps murderous and aggressive emotions that at this very time, of course, Sigmund Freud was writing about in Vienna. Remember that Freud himself was a Hitler émigré, came to spend his last year or two in London. In fact, the whole Freud family. I shall later on mention one of his sons, the architect Ernst Freud, and one of his sons, the artist Lucian Freud. So the whole Freud family are part of the saga that I'm talking to you about this evening. Now, I want to say a few words about what I called, can't remember what I called it, kind of mechanical grandeur, modern machinery capable of anything. Not something, I should say that many of these things I'm talking about are not confined to the arts of Central Europe, of course. Many of the, think of Tatlin's Tower, if you want to think about grandeur, and you know, buildings that are sky high. Think of, you know, next time you go to Rome or Milan, have a look at the railway stations there. What I'm talking about was not only the confined to Central Europe, but again, let me give you an example from a Fritz Lang film of the kind of thing I have in mind. This is from the film Metropolis. Colossal film, nearly bankrupted the studio, wonderful film. This is the granddaddy of all the, you know, all the James Bond movies, for example. That airplane is not there because it's about to fly into a skyscraper. It's there, of course, to show you how very high the skyscraper is. Again, the story needn't delay us. It's a kind of semi-Marxian tract about the rich people up there and all the plebs down here, and there's a kind of pleb revolt, and at the end of it they all shake hands and it's all going to be all right. Again, the story isn't the point. The design is extraordinary. To this day, the design is extraordinary. Not only the grandeur of it and the image of this enormous technological stupendous future, but look also at the diminution of individuality of the people, the trucks, the wagons, the trains. I should say that I'm here not as necessarily an advocate. Some of the things I'm talking about and some of the things I write about in the book I personally admire and love and take to. Some of the things I don't. I'll show you a few buildings later on I wouldn't particularly enjoy living in. But I do think this is a wonderful film. I do love the paintings of somebody like Feininger, for example. One of those artists associated with the Bauhaus, which I'll mention in a moment. Feininger, who was, I think, actually born in the States, but lived in Germany, was very much a German artist, later on had to leave. When you look at that, it's, of course, a painting of a church, mid-1920s, I think. It's not a bit like an English painting of a church at the same period. Just imagine an English painting of, you know, Salisbury Cathedral circa 1925. You can just imagine it. There'd be kind of clouds and the sun coming through and a bit of rain and a little lady walking the dog and passing the vicar. And the, you know, it would be a lovely painting, but a very different style of painting, very different kind of painting. You look at Feininger, it's geometrical. Look at all those triangles. Look at all the parallel lines. It's formal. It's modern with a capital M. This is the period when Schoenberg is saying, look, we've had lyricism, harmony, Brahmsian harmonies have gone as far as they can. We need to revolutionize music by using the new 12-tone system. It's an analogy in a way. You look at a painting by Feininger, I find it very beautiful, but in a different way from a traditional English painting. The inspiration is very much the same as the inspiration that led to the building of Salisbury Cathedral in the first place. The architects of Salisbury Cathedral, like Lionel Feininger, did everything they could. They strained every nerve to raise the eye and to raise the spirits upwards. And I think in its own way this works beautifully. Much the same was being done in the world of dance. In Britain, in the 1920s and 30s, we had plenty of dance. There's lots of ballet, lots of Giselle and Swan Lake and Sylphide and Nutcracker. The Diaghilev Company continued to visit. The Vic Wells was beginning, young Ninette de Valois was beginning. What we didn't have was much modern dance, capital M, modern dance. In Germany they did. People like Laban, choreographer, dancer, notator of dance steps, theoretician of dance. Later on, after getting rather too close to the Nazis, he left, came to Britain, died in Britain, spent the Second World War. All the chaps were away fighting the war, so Laban spent the Second World War helping to teach the women how to unload very heavy trucks by using dance movements. When Laban wished to portray a dancer, he was a very good artist, he didn't do a pretty little girl in a tutu like Dürger. He was interested in the abstraction of movement, movement-ness almost. Now, I know that this does sound a little inhumane and formal and geometrical and anti-naturalistic, and I do want to say a word or two about the great social conscience of many of the artists of this period. I mentioned the Throppany Opera before. Think of the Threepenny Opera. There isn't a bar in that that doesn't have some huge social concern in it. It's not sentimental. It's tough. It's cabaret. It's brutal. But it's inspired by a passionate social conscience. And so were many of the other artists in the period that we're talking about. People like George Grosz, who in the 1920s would see that the Weimar Republic wasn't working, the attempt at democracy in Germany. People were killing each other in the streets. He would portray, at the time of the Great Inflation, when, you know, mother had to put millions of mark notes into a wheelbarrow and trundle off to get a loaf of bread. Others, the bishops and the generals and the politicians, were stuffing themselves at the expense of the people. And George Grosz would portray this in a ruthless fashion. Otto Dix, another member of what became known as the Neue Sachlichkeit, the new realism, this new unblinking realism. Otto Dix would paint what he called to beauty. It's not beautiful in a sense. It's rather like, do you remember that movie a few years ago, American Beauty, which ostensibly was all about the beauty of lovely, nice, clean, lovely American suburbia. And as you watched that film, you gradually discovered, you know, this one is a homicidal lunatic, this one is a dipsomaniac, that one lusts after that one's teenage daughter. You know, it showed you that beauty is not always beauty. Same here, to beauty. What does Otto Dix paint? He paints a very wealthy, selfish yuppie. Do you use the word yuppie in Canada? You know, he's got rich, somebody's made a fortune on the stock market, doesn't give a damn about you, is watching to make sure you don't get any of it. Look at those unblinking eyes. I'll refer to those later on again. Hand in his pocket, make sure the money stays there. Other hand is holding the latest kind of telephone. I'm rich. I can buy anything I want. What I find beautiful, I can buy. You can't. I can buy the latest kind of, I guess it was the kind of mobile of its day, the latest kind of gramophone, the latest women I can buy. I expect this whole thing takes place in one of those brothels in Berlin in the 1920s that Christopher Isherwood wrote about. It is deeply socially satirical of this harsh cabaret style. There were, of course, artists who wore their heart much more overtly on their sleeve. Wonderful woman, Käthe Kollwitz, some of you will know the name, lived right through until the Second World War. She was a Marxist, passionate concern with social equality. At the time of the Great Inflation, when the kids were calling upon Mother Brot, they wanted bread and Mother couldn't provide, this is exactly what Kollwitz portrayed directly. In 3 weeks' time, I shall be in Berlin, and whenever I go there, I always make a pilgrimage to her house in Fasanenstrasse, it's now a museum, and you look at some of these wonderful, heart-rending drawings she did very courageously in the 20s and indeed 30s. And I look at some of this and I'm reminded of the drawings that Vicky, the Supermac man, did much later on in the 1950s and 1960s in England. As well as drawing Macmillan and Eisenhower and Khrushchev and everybody, Vicky also had a great social conscience, and he would draw the impoverishment of London's East End or of Calcutta, while millions were being spent on, you know, rocketry by the Kennedy regime or whatever. And I'm sure, although I don't have documentary proof of this, that Vicky would have picked up some of this from the drawings of Käthe Kollwitz. But if we're talking about the social conscience of pre-Hitlerian Central Europe, particularly the Weimar period in Germany, I suppose the place one has to go to is the Bauhaus, the great college of art and architecture and design and engineering, originated in Weimar, moved to Dessau, presided over by its great founding director, Walter Gropius. And Gropius gathered around him some extraordinary people, Feininger, whom I mentioned, Klee, Kandinsky, Marcel Breuer, Albers, many of the great figures of the first third of the last century. And they were concerned with modernity. Here is the Bauhaus building itself, no decor, functional, if you like. we're going to have a lot of architecture students. They need a lot of natural light. Right, let's consult the engineers and see if we can't have a complete curtain wall of glass. They had an amazing philosophy. It was a kind of Karl Marx meets William Morris meets Henry Ford, if you can imagine those three in a room together. What they said was this. They said, we want to create ordinary household objects, lampshades, pens and, you know, pens and pencils, desks, beds, apartment blocks, cruet sets, everything from the smallest to the largest, beautifully designed, using modern materials, no unnecessary decor, and then we want to mass produce this stuff, that's where Henry Ford comes into it, and make them available, therefore, at reasonable prices for ordinary people so that the ordinary cultural level of ordinary homes will rise. It was very visionary. It was something that was deeply to inspire the great guru of design in Britain 30 years later, Sir Terence Conran, a name that some of you will know. Conran told me, when I was interviewing him some years ago, he said, when I was beginning in the late 50s and 60s, it was the Bauhaus that influenced me. I wanted to do what they aspired to do. So this then, if you like, and I'm summarizing like crazy, and I do apologize, is something of the, I won't say it was the entire culture of pre-Hitlerian Europe, of course not. People are people. When I asked one of my interviewees, you know, did you as a young man go to the films and did you see Caligari and M and so on? He said, well, I remember going to the movies a lot, but what I most remember was going to Laurel and Hardy. The Amadeus Quartet, those boys loved Schubert far more than they loved Schoenberg. I don't want to exaggerate. All I've tried to suggest by way of a very brief summary is the frontier, the cutting edge of the aesthetic of Central Europe by the early 30s, by 1933, when Hitler comes to power. And remember that Hitler, in addition to all his other many, many crimes, was a failed artist. You may have seen some of his drawings or paintings. They're not bad in a nice little old-fashioned way. But if you read Mein Kampf, many of his bitterest feelings, some of the deep paranoia that raged in him, dated back, by his own account at least, to the moment when he was rejected by the Academy in Vienna. The Vienna Academy rejected him, and he hated... Have I said... He's not here, is he? Okay. You get a bit worried on these, you know, you read in the papers. Incidentally, Kokoschka, great artist who lived in London for many, many years, in his old age, Kokoschka lived to be 90-odd. When it became possible to joke about these things, Kokoschka used to say to people, you know, Hitler and I were up for the same place in the Vienna Academy. Tragically for humanity, I was the one who was accepted. But, you know, the Nazi regime had a policy on everything, including, of course, the arts, and what they wanted was to suppress as brutally and instantly as possible the whole cosmopolitan modern culture I've been summarizing to you. They thought of it as Jewish, Bolshevik, everything they didn't like. And indeed, within weeks of coming to power, the book burnings began. When I'm in Berlin in December, I'm actually taking a little group of opera lovers and lecturing to them there. And when we go to the opera house on Unter den Linden, the house that Hitler himself, of course, used to go to, presided over now by Daniel Barenboim. Hitler would have loved that, wouldn't he? Right next to the opera house is the great square on which not so long ago students and their professors were exulting in destroying the works of Freud and Einstein and Heinrich Mann, and not only Jews and not only Germans, Proust, I mean, all the great figures. And it's the most moving memorial in Berlin, by the way, is right there in the middle of that square. It's very simple. You can walk over it without noticing it. It's simply a square, Perspex square, and you stand by it and you look down, and beneath your feet are rows and rows of library shelves, empty. Very simple, very moving. And a little quote from Heine. A people who burn books will end by burning people. That was 1933. Before long, of course, things got much worse. Art objects were being brought out of the museums, put into a special exhibition in Munich and then traveling around Germany so that people could laugh at not only the great German artists, the expressionists that I mentioned before, but all the great modern figures of the first third of the last century and laugh at them as degenerate. And then in 1938, Austria becomes part of the Third Reich. The screw tightens harder on the aesthetic and intellectual community. Imagine what it must have been like being anybody with an ounce of intellectual or artistic integrity that there in Berlin is a regime that destroys art and culture. People tried to leave. Some big figures who had international connections, like Ebert and Busch and Bing, whom I mentioned before, got out. Others rapidly tried to. And there's a big debate, which I won't delay you with now, as to whether Britain, and indeed other countries, and indeed Canada for that matter, could or should have been perhaps more generous with the asylum seekers of the day than they were. I think actually Britain, considering there was severe recession, was quite generous, particularly in the final year before the war, 38-39, when 10,000 youngsters were permitted to enter Britain, the kinder transport, the children's transport. But then, of course, the war began, and it came to an end. And many, many who wanted to get out didn't. Many of those who did left behind relatives who were murdered. We're talking, ladies and gentlemen, about a total who came to Britain, settled and stayed in Britain, of 50, 55,000 perhaps, not very many. Today, 2002, I think we have something like 70 or 80,000 applications for asylum a year. So we're talking about a very small number of people, most of whom were not great artists or musicians, but did what we all try and do and lived their quiet lives. But what I want to do in the remainder of the lecture is talk about the impact of that generation of culture carriers on the British aesthetic world. Basically, I suppose there were two mechanisms which I picked up from my interviews. Some people said, we loved the English so much. They saved our lives. Used to say England in those days. You have to say Britain now, by the way. It is as politically incorrect for me to say I'm an Englishman as for me to ask you what part of America you come from, if you follow the analogy. And nowadays we say Britain. In those days, they all talked about the King of England. So, we love the English, they used to say. They saved our lives. And what we wanted to do was to contribute as much as we could to England. So I learned to wear a bowler hat, and I was embarrassed about my accent, and I read the Times, and I learned about cricket, and so on. Some of them overdid it. There's a wonderful story of a man. You know, they didn't get naturalization at first. They had to wait till well after the war. There was a man who finally gets his naturalization in about 1949. And instead of being happy, he bursts into tears. And somebody says to him, but Helmut, why are you crying? Now you don't have to cry. He said, I know, I'm British. I'm crying because why did we have to lose India? You don't get much more English than that. And indeed, in the one of the things I've tried to talk about in my book is the way some of the artists, some of the composers who were trained in the Schoenberg School, went and studied with Vaughan Williams and wanted to do wanted to anglicize their music. They did what they could for the British arts. Others came to Britain and they said, we love the English, they're terrific, they saved our life, but the poor dears, culturally, they live in the past. The least we could do would be to bring to these poor, benighted Brits a little bit of modernism. I'll give you examples of both of those. Let me start, as I began the lecture as a whole, with film. This is the great film mogul Alexander Korda, K-O-R-D-A, Hungarian-born, trained, learned his craft, of course, in Berlin, as you would expect, wasn't a refugee, came to England after working in Hollywood and elsewhere, came in 31, set up his company, and he wanted to do his thing by England. So he called his company London Films, and he used as his logo Big Ben, and he stuck a couple of great big Union Jacks outside the front door, And here he is making one of his early films, not only producing but personally directing The Private Life of Henry VIII. You don't get much, you know, the one with all the chicken bones and Charles Laughton, wonderful film. Incidentally, all those fabulous Tudor interiors are designed by Korda's brother Vincent Korda, another Hungarian. I don't suppose the Korda brothers had ever heard of the Tudors 5 years before, and there they are making The Private Life of Henry VIII. And he goes on, and he makes a lot of wonderful kind of imperial blockbusters, The Four Feathers, The Drum, some of these great films, a film with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh about Nelson and Lady Hamilton, in which Nelson, it was made in the United States in 1940, 41, before Pearl Harbor, and it was a way of trying to enlist American support for the war effort. So there you have Olivier dressed up as Nelson, but really speaking for Churchill, saying to the Navy in 1800, the continent is united under this monstrous megalomaniac who's going to invade us. If we let him invade us, you know, British civilization will come to an end. And it played its part, I'm sure, in bringing American sympathy for the British. And indeed, Korda went on and got a knighthood. He never pretended to be an Englishman, but he did his thing for England. He also did his thing, though, for the refugee community. If you look at the credits of a Korda film, they are packed. Not so much with actors, because if you have an accent, there are only so many roles you can play, but the musical score, the cinematography, the design, the makeup, the script very often. A plethora of continental talent came to his company. And indeed, there were so many people from the continent working there that the joke was people would drive past and they saw these two British flags and they said, that's for the two British-born employees that he has in there. This was Korda. But I mentioned also the idea of bringing modernism to Britain. Let me return to dance. Many of you will know the name of Kurt Joss, J-O-O-S-S, Juice. The Ballet Joss, the whole Joss company came out of Germany to Dartington in Devon, which they used as their base, and they did valiant work. They toured Britain during the 30s and 40s and into the 50s. They didn't so much take Giselle and Swanlake and Nutcracker around. What they wanted to do much more was to introduce to British audiences modern dance and modern design. And when you look at a picture like that from one of their productions, you see, I think, a cousin or a great nephew, perhaps, of some of the shadow effects that I showed you from Expressionist film a moment ago. So film, dance, design, maybe I should say a word about furniture design. This is the famous Isokon long chair of Marcel Breuer, another of the great figures associated with the Bauhaus, a man who was a designer, also an architect. Doesn't look so revolutionary to us. We've all sat on long chairs like that and very comfortable. They are too. But it was quite revolutionary in its time. First of all, in a way, Breuer did for people what Lubetkin did for penguins. He observed scientifically, you know, how we're shaped, where our curves are, how we are in leisure, and built a chair around that function so that the form followed the function. And furthermore, you can see the materials it's made from. They're modern. They're not disguised. They're not upholstered away. This is a kind of modernism applied to furniture design. And of course, above all, you see that in architecture. This is, in fact, not designed by an emigre. Well, it is. He's a different kind of emigre. He was a Canadian, Wells Coates, who lived in Britain. I think he was actually born in Japan. Somebody will correct me, but I think he was raised and trained in Canada, lived in Britain, and was one of those young architects who, of whom there were not many, who was very receptive to the European idea, to Corbusier, to the Bauhaus, to the international style. And he designed these flats in Belsize Park near Hampstead. In fact, when Gropius lived in England for a period in the 1930s, that was where he lived. Agatha Christie lived there as well. Quite a number of celebs lived there. But this was very much a magnet for the Hitler emigres who settled in and around Hampstead and Belsize Park and Swiss Cottage. I show you that. It's still there, that building. And you see something of the style, the horizontality, the Many of those buildings were painted white. They remind me very often of the decks of a Cunard liner from the 1920s and 30s. You know what I mean? Have a look at this one. It's not painted white, but in many ways, it's a smaller equivalent. You can imagine the captain's bridge up there, you know. I took that photo a couple of years ago, and the reason I show you that one in particular is that the architect of this block of flats in Hampstead was Ernst Freud, son of Sigmund Freud and father of Lucian Freud. I don't want to exaggerate and suggest that that style caught on with everybody. It didn't. When my parents wanted to build their first house, they didn't want a boxy Bauhaus style. They wanted something with a Tudor beam down it. This wasn't that popular. But it did become popular, first of all, with young architects like Wells Coates or like Dennis Lasden, who died recently, the architect of the National Theatre in London, who worked with Lubetkin. And it also caught on with some of the more progressive local councils, like, for example, Bexhill. I mentioned the Bexhill Pavilion before. Or like Finsbury in a poorer part of East London. They wanted a new health centre, and they wanted their health centre not to be built in a kind of old-fashioned, grand, pompous style, as they put it, or as the studio put it. They wanted something modern, sleek. This is by Lubetkin. And you see there the clean, modern lines, blocks of glass, flat roof, modernism in council architecture. And it did catch on. It began to catch on. It even caught on during the war with the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, ABCA. Can you imagine the propaganda branch of the British Army putting up posters to the boys? Keep fighting, chaps. The war's nearly over. It'll be you will inherit the New Britain. And what was the New Britain that they portrayed? It wasn't thatched cottage and roses around the door. It was a kind of Finsbury Health Centre, modernity. When I look at that building, the one I'm most reminded of is what was the first major permanent public building erected in Britain after the war, and that was the Royal Festival Hall, the centrepiece of the Festival of Britain, 1951, the very encapsulation of many of the aspects of the international movement in architecture. If you go to the Festival Hall, the great spaces, the huge amounts of glass, the modern materials, the cantilevering of the hall itself above the public spaces, those flyaway boxes in the hall itself, there'd be nothing remotely like that in British theatrical architecture until the Royal Festival Hall. And the architects, Leslie Martin, Robert Matthew, wanted it to be the showcase. You know, modernism has finally arrived in Britain. And the man they appointed to do all that detail was, in fact, Peter Morrow, an architect born, I think, in Heidelberg. And when you're at the Festival Hall, next time you're in London, walk along the river a few yards, and you will see our National Theatre, designed by Dennis Lasden, who was, as I say, a pupil of Lubetkin, among others. I must say, this is an example of one I don't terribly like. I was there not so long ago, so I'm going to show you a rather small picture of it rather quickly. But when you look at it, you see something of the same, the horizontality, the cantilevering, the brutal exterior of the building. You can file your nails on it. Go further along the river to the Design Museum, the creation of Sir Terence Conran, the man who told me how very much he was influenced by the Bauhaus. And the Design Museum itself, the very building of it, is an encapsulation of Bauhaus ideas. At the risk of overrunning, I just must tell you a little story. I was watching poor beleaguered Prince Charles on the television the other day, for whom I have a lot of admiration. Terence Conran apparently told me that he wrote to Prince Charles when they were going to open the Design Museum and said, would you be so good as to open it for us officially? And Charles wrote back, or got somebody to write back and say, well, sounds very interesting. Sounds like, why don't you bring the blueprints, bring the designs along to Highgrove or wherever, and we can have a good look at it, we can chat about it. So Conran took these designs along, and Charles apparently looked at all this stuff, and he's, of course, no fool when it comes to reading architectural designs. Charles is very good at that. And he looked at this stuff, and he's very intelligent, and he said, Terence, it's a very good idea. I'm glad you're doing a design museum. I'm sure, you know, London really needs one. Terrific idea. I've got one or two questions. The roof, I may be wrong, but it looks terribly kind of angular. Wouldn't it be nice to have a nice, great, big kind of sloping A-frame roof, maybe, and a few, you know, and some brickwork, and some... The windows, they look a little kind of... frugal, with little curlicues. By the way, are you sure you want it all painted white? Finally he said, forgive me, Terence, I just don't think it's me. And you can see why. Prince Charles's architectural tastes and Terence Conran's inspiration, they are twigs from different branches of the complex tree of British architectural history. And the whole story, of course, has moved on, as indeed we'd better ourselves. Many of the Hitler émigrés, they all did what they could during the war. Many of them were locked up. They were interned as technically enemy aliens for a while. Three members of the Amadeus Quartet met each other in British prison. But they got out. They did their thing for the war. John Hartfield, Herzfeld, one of the great founders of photomontage, would do designs of this sort for the cover of Picture Post. Picture Post, the great British illustrated magazine founded and edited by Stefan Laurent, a name you will know from his Canadian years. And here you have two émigrés. It's a witty cover. It's a clever cover. It's long before computer graphics. And yet at the same time, it's two émigrés trying to alert the Brits to what awaits them. There was a deep, serious concern even among the wits about what was going on. Think of poor Vicky, the Supermac man, terrified when Hitler and Stalin sign a pact. And then Hitler breaks the pact, marches on the Soviet Union, thinks it'll be a walkover. And of course, as you well know, it wasn't a walkover. The Soviet troops gradually turned the whole war around at the Battle of Stalingrad. And Vicky, who was drawing for one of the leading British newspapers by then, had a wonderful time imagining the nightmare that Hitler would have had thinking about the enigmatic smile on the face of Stalin. It's brilliant, it's tragic, and it's funny. I did promise you that I'd say a word or two about... I mentioned where I think Vicky got some of his ideas from. I do owe it to Vicky to tell you where I think some of his ideas have led to. While I've been traveling, and as Hector said at the beginning, I've been traveling now for nearly 2 months. While I was, I think, in Australia or New Zealand, to my amazement, I noticed in the newspaper constant references to one of our former prime ministers, who I thought everybody had forgotten, a rather grey, dull, thoughtful, sensible man called John Major. Now, when John Major was prime minister, the cartoonists had a terrible time thinking how to portray him in a witty way. And eventually, one of them, one of the leading cartoonists from The Guardian, Steve Bell, came up with this wonderful idea. Poor John Major, he was seen to be so gauche that he wouldn't even know that you're not supposed to put your underpants over your shirt. And that is how poor John Major was portrayed. This is long before we knew that he'd had an affair with one of his colleagues. This is back in the mid-90s. It's funny, and I feel embarrassed showing it to you because I have rather a lot of affection for Major. I think he was not such a bad prime minister. But what Steve Bell is doing, among other things, is he is creating a deliberate parody as a homage to the Supermac memory. Here's another example of it. So the Vicky imagery lives on. And just in order to be extremely fair-minded, because I'm abroad and you're not supposed to be partisan about your own politics, I want to show you a cartoon from the Times last year about Tony Blair. You know how Blair is always thought to be sailing around the world trying to save it, and is supposed to be a great control freak, and you never know what the news is because it's always being spun. Spin doctors here, spin doctors there, and that Blair is the master of spin. So there was a cartoon of Tony Blair just a year ago in the Times showing also the Superman image and very specifically referring back to Vicky, Super Blair to Supermac Mark II, or a spin too far. So there you have the whole lineage, the culture carrying, from Käthe Kollwitz to Vicky to the John Major image to today. I mentioned the Freud family. I mentioned Sigmund Freud, his son, the architect, his son, the painter. Look at the paintings of Lucian Freud, 80 this year. You probably saw the reproduction of the painting he did of the Queen recently, the one with the looking rather dour with a green chin. She does look rather dour, but she doesn't have a green chin. But his paintings, if you look at that, remember the eyes of that yuppie from the Neue Sachlichkeit by Otto Dix. I see again and again, I don't know, Freud doesn't give interviews, I haven't met him, but I bet in his father's home there were paintings by those 1920s painters that he would have seen as a boy. And I feel when I looked at the 80th anniversary exhibition in London a few months ago, and there I saw painting after painting that looked to me to be inspired by the paintings of people like Otto Dix and George Grosz in the 1920s. Film, certainly in our own time, has been influenced by the émigré culture. This is the third man. We think of Graham Greene, we think of Orson Welles. But remember, it takes place in Vienna. It's an idea of Alexander Korda. And it's designed with all those shadow effects and long lines by Vincent Korda. Think of the James Bond films. Designed film after film by Ken Adam, Klaus Adam, boy brought up in Hitler's Berlin, who designed film after film about some megalomaniac monster who wished to destroy the world. Some of you, I know, already have a copy of my book, and you'll have noticed Ken Adam has actually lent me a couple of his original drawings for Moonraker. And I see in those the strong horizontal and lateral lines that seem to me to be derived from the expressionism of Caligari in that era. He was also the man who designed Dr. Strangelove with the great tapering walls of the war room, you know, as the president watches the imminent destruction of the world. You know, Reagan was supposed to have said when he came to the White House, first day he said to his chief of staff he'd like to see the war room because he'd seen it on Dr. Strangelove, you know. And the general said, well, I'm sorry, Mr. President, the real one isn't anything like as good as the one in the film. The film was designed by Ken Adam. You know, if I'm to begin to generalize and to sum up, many of the people I've mentioned, it's true of Sir Ernst Gombrich, the great art historian, the director of the Warburg Institute, the author of The Story of Art that many of us have on our shelves, and Art and Illusion. These people helped professionalize an artistic life that was in many ways amateur. They did it in art, art history, architecture, in many of the fields, but also, for example, in music, where somebody like the great conductor Sir George Scholte came to Covent Garden, found it a little bit amateurish. By the time he left, he'd turned it into what he said he'd turn it into, probably the finest opera house in the world. Wasn't always loved for it. Man of enormous dynamism, too much energy and dynamism for kind of uptight Brits. They used to laugh at him, used to laugh at his Hungarian accent, you know. But then I used to sing under him. I sing in one of the big London choirs. And he would come up to people and be very jovial, enormous magnetic energy, and he'd say, ah, I know you think my accent is so funny, but think how many languages I can speak in this accent, huh? And that kind of shut us up. And then there were the Amadeus Quartet, who, as I've already mentioned, I think in many ways richly enlivened our musical life. I'm going to show you one more cartoon, then I want to sum up in a sentence or two with the lights on. There was a wonderful cartoon. The Amadeus Quartet was so well known that you simply had to say quartet, chamber music, it meant the Amadeus. Some years ago, another subject relevant to this very day, alas, hijacking. Do you remember when there were all those hijackings to Havana? And there was a wonderful cartoon in one of the British newspapers. The captain of a big airliner was looking around, and he suddenly sees walking onto the first-class compartment these four sinister characters holding their big packages, you see. And he turns round to his co-pilot and he says, oh my God, this is either another unscheduled stop in Cuba or that's the Amadeus String Quartet. Forgive me, ladies and gentlemen, I've overrun. It's a huge story, and because I was enjoying talking to you, and I hope you've enjoyed me talking to you, I told you one or two extra stories about Prince Charles and other people that perhaps are slightly immaterial. It's a serious subject, though. I'd like to sum up just by saying the following. First of all, don't exaggerate. I don't want to suggest that without this particular wave of asylum seekers, of migrants, Britain would have been without culture. Of course not. We all, you and I alike, live in rich, multicultural societies, the roots of which have been watered from many, many sources over the years. When I think back over British cultural history, the Romans, the Angles and Saxons, the Normans, the Huguenots, the Irish, on and on it goes. I have two children in their 20s, bright, lovely kids. They're not interested in Schulte and Gombrich and the Amadeus Quartet. Their world has moved on. My children live in a world of Britpop and postmodernism and internet and Afro-Caribbean influences and Indian influences, fusion music, world music, and they're right. They're right. All I've been trying to share with you is one chapter, I think an important chapter, but one chapter in a very long and complicated and rich mix. I want to end by thanking you for having me and by giving you a quotation. And I should say that at the end of the lecture, I think we may or may not have time for a little bit of public questioning. I'm not leaving the city for another 2 days, so I'm going to be sitting out there on the exit for as long as you like. Do come and chat to me individually later on for as long as you want to. I would like to end my kind of formal presentation, and I do apologize to all concerned for going on for much too long, with a quotation, not from a Brit, but from an American, because there is this huge American story as well that I've scarcely alluded to. This was Walter Cook, director of the Art Institute in New York in the 1930s. He must have been quite a whimsical man. He, of course, America hugely benefited Chagall, Max Ernst, Panofsky, the art historian. Anybody involved in the art world in New York would have hugely benefited from those émigrés. And Walter Cook used to shock people in the late 1930s in words that I would echo. He used to say to people, you know, Hitler is my best friend. He shakes the tree and we pick up the apples. Thank you. I don't know what the rules are and whether we're allowed to have questions on the floor.
We have time for 10 or 15 minutes of questions.
Good. Sir. Yeah. The question was, many of these people left because of Hitler, not because of Germany. How many of them went back after the war? No, it's a very important and very good question. The answer is not very many, and I was slightly surprised at that. Another of the original possible titles of my book was going to be The Hitler Exiles. There's a big industry in exile studies. And I remember interviewing a very distinguished historian, emeritus professor at Oxford. He said to me, this was a man in his late 70s, he said, I'm not an exile. I lived in Berlin for 15 years and I lived in, you know, Oxford or London for the next 60. An exile is somebody who yearns to go back to the Heimat, the homeland. I didn't want to do that. This is my home. And very few went back because after the war, they'd been fighting the war, they became British, they got British boyfriends and girlfriends and jobs and were proud to be English and felt that Germany was not a place for them. A few went back. Some who were very politically left-wing went back to communist East Germany, as Brecht, for example, did, or John Hartfield. A few left-wingers went back, therefore, to East Berlin, particularly. A handful, Max Born, the great physicist, Nobel Prize winner, went back to Germany to help regenerate German science after the war. He felt he had a duty to help the new young Germany. Got severely wrapped over the knuckles by Einstein for setting foot in Germany again. Many of them did their thing for Germany. The Amadeus Quartet had an exclusive contract for many years with Deutsche Grammophon, recorded in Hamburg and Munich, and played in Germany and Austria, and brought to the Viennese and the people in Munich and Frankfurt
a Viennese style of music making that had almost been obliterated in Germany itself and Austria itself. But very, very few actually went back to what had been their former homeland. Thank you for asking that. Lady here. What, the question from the lady here is, what about the women? I'm aware of the fact that my book and therefore my lecture are politically incorrect in many respects. It is mostly about England, not about Scotland. I mentioned the Edinburgh Festival. That's good. The serious answer to your question is, of course, there were women who made an impact in the arts. Lucy Rhee, for example, a leading ceramicist and potter. There were a number. I just showed you the penultimate slide, a drawing of the Amadeus Quartet, was by a wonderful woman artist, Milan Kosman, who's happily still alive and wonderful, still drawing. But not that many. Remember that the people I'm talking about came from a culture, a very traditional, old, male-dominated culture. The man was the lawyer, the professor, the judge, the scientist, and the woman looked after the home and the children and ran the home and the servants, and that was in itself quite an industry. But there were not that... The reason I talked almost entirely about men was not a bias on my part, but because the subject matter is much, much more about men than about women. Because after all, they came from a very male-dominated society where women, yes, there were a few actresses, a few singers. By and large, the great impact in these fields was from men. But it's a good question to have to deal with. Yes, sir. Thank you. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. What would have happened if the tree hadn't been shaken? We've all, in our different ways, benefited from that migration. Very interesting question. I actually asked some of my interviewees what sort of lives and careers they might have had if Hitler hadn't happened. It's, of course, almost too hypothetical because it's part of the whole of history. I asked several people, some of them, incidentally, quite a number of the people that I interviewed have since died, because I was talking to people in their old age. I'm very struck by the way this whole subject is one that's just moving now from memory into history, you know? Another 20 years and I couldn't have written this book. People like Gombrich, the great art historian, people like Popper, the philosopher whom I mentioned, I suspect that quite a number of those people are the Amadeus members. They were obviously outstandingly talented people. But I suspect that if Popper had continued to be a philosopher working away in Vienna, or Gombrich writing art history, or Zygmunt Nissl had grown up and been a very good chamber violinist in Vienna, it is quite possible they would not have had the world celebrity they later developed. In many ways, emigration worked very well for them, partly because they were very lucky and very talented, but also because of the historical circumstance. London, in particular, in the late 40s, 1950s, was a sensational place to be if you were talented, pushy, well-connected, entrepreneurial. You know, it was a good place to start a new publishing company. The recording industry was coming to London. The BBC started the third programme for cultural programmes. The Arts Council was set up. The Royal Opera House, as a permanent opera and ballet company, was established. All the old, the old great centres, Budapest, Prague, Berlin, Vienna, they were all marginalised by the war. London was, for all these accidental reasons, a tremendous place to be if you were starting a cultural career. And English was a wonderful language to be writing in. Gombrich and Popper and so many other people got a far bigger audience by writing in English than they ever would if they'd written in Germany. So for various accidental reasons, some of them beyond the control of the individuals, those who made it and were not murdered, we must always remember, those who made it probably made it bigger by having to leave Central Europe than if they hadn't had to leave Central Europe. Thank you. Yes, lady. Oh, gosh, there's a large question. To go back a stage, what produced this aesthetic modernity in Central Europe? I'm not going to answer that because it's late, the headlines would go back really to 19th century nationalism, to the development of German unity, to the drawing together of so many of the what had been the separate states of Germany, and also in the case, for example, of those who were Jewish in Central Europe, the fact that many of them had come from families that had been a generation or two earlier, like the Freuds or the Marxes before Freud and Marx, Eastern European small town shtetl Orthodox, had thought that by moving westwards into the German world, the world of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, after all, and of Schiller and Goethe and Bach and Beethoven, they were moving up the social scale, and therefore they were thinking of themselves as being people who were moving into high culture. That in itself led them to rethink culture in a way that they wouldn't have done when they were living in the Fiddler on the Roof shtetl generations before. And they made this move just about the time when Germany was being united, and therefore there's a huge emphasis on the importance of high culture, which they were rethinking in various ways. It's very hard to disentangle this from the insights of particular individuals, and I've mentioned some of them already. When you have people thinking through new thoughts in the way that people like Freud were beginning to do, you also have in the case of Vienna and the dual monarchy of Austro-Hungary, also a sense of danger, excitement, who knows where this is going, can it last, it'll be there as long as this particular emperor is there, a kind of forward-thinkingness with an element of fear and danger to it. These are when you get the breakthroughs. I should also, of course, say that when I rattle off these names like Schnitzler and Freud and Adolf Loosener, I'm talking about the handful of very great superstars. There were also suicides, depression, people who weren't able to make it, and people who wanted desperately to live in a past that they saw moving away from them. These are simply headlines to what is an enormous separate subject, but you're right to raise it. But don't ask me what led to it. Thank you.
We have time for one more question.
You choose the question. Okay.
The Hitler's emigres are pre-war. And
most of them. All I can do is agree with you. That is certainly the case, and the reason that people are leaving now is very different from the reason that people were leaving Germany at that time. I suppose one way of, I don't want to talk too much detail about the contemporary world, but of course everything that I've been saying, there are reverberations for our own times. I'm very conscious that I've been talking about asylum seekers, immigration. I'm very conscious that I've been talking about cultural transfer. And also, given the unsteady world that we're all into at the moment, about the way there are occasional silver linings to very dangerous and dark clouds. I wouldn't want to say that the émigrés I spoke about were typical of waves of migration. They tended to be educated upper middle class, not the huddled masses yearning to be free, as most waves of migration in the past had been. they were much more like the brain drain that we're talking about today. The interesting question, the difficult one, is how far one can generalize about the nature of the culture thereby being transferred. I tried to hint at a few summaries. I talked about the professionalization of British culture. I might have said that some of the people I was speaking about tried to be bridges between cultures, tried to cosmopolitanize what they thought to be a rather insular British culture, for example. Various things of that kind, which I didn't bother to spell out, but I write about in the course of the book. When you talk about the migration from the poorer parts of the world to the richer part of the world today, of course the motivation is different. I'm not sure how far the culture is being brought and in which direction. I think the real answer to your question is one you and I have to speak in about 50 years' time and then try and assess in retrospect the nature of what has been brought and what has been lost. In the same way that it's taken us really until now to begin to assess the cultural impact of the people that I was speaking about.
Last week we had the Jewish vote, this week we've had the Jewish vote people. And a great pleasure to invite a member of our board, Dr. Ralph Jorsch, to thank the speaker tonight.
We have had a very exciting evening. One of the important things in my past was 1932, when my father arrived home with our first radio. Now, Canadian radio takes a backseat to no country in the world. But one of the things that enriched our radio was the fact that 9 o'clock in the morning, we started off with the BBC News. And at noon, I listened to the Archers. And at various times during the day, we would have rebroadcasts of the third program. So I have a long familiarity with the BBC. And I can see that it was because of men like our speaker that the BBC made as much of a contribution as they did and enriched us greatly. Now, I also feel we've benefited enormously today by being filled in a time of history that is of vital importance to us all. All these names that he mentioned are household words. When I went to museums, traveled in Europe, all of these things were part of our lives. And our speaker has helped to straighten that area out, let us know what it was all about. Because even though I lived through those years, the research that you've done and presented to us has been wonderful. And I may say we've also benefited greatly by your style. Now, my belief is any good lecture is good show business. Today, we've had a demonstration of how good it can get. We, sir, are indebted to you, and we owe you a vote of gratitude.
Mr. Snowman will be going up outside the door where there is a desk with his books, and he'll be there to talk to people who want to meet him individually.